Welcome to the Old Mold Variety Hour, Claire Glenn and Kira Kelly.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thanks so much for having us.
Well, you are staff attorneys with the Climate Defense Project and been working with water protectors facing criminal charges in Minnesota related to resistance to Enbridge Company's Line 3 pipeline. So let's start with what is happening with water protectors who are still facing criminal charges, even several years later, and then talk about dilemmas around legal strategies and use of the courts and the climate justice movement. So, can each of you begin by talking a little about your work with the Climate Defense Project, and then we'll turn to what's happening with these cases around resistance to Line 3. Claire Glenn, why don't you start?
So I started as a staff attorney with the Climate Defense Project in February of 2023, but really I started taking activist cases a year prior to that as a fellow with the Civil Liberties Defense Center and Water Protector Legal Collective. Before that, I had worked as a public defender in Maryland and Minnesota, representing people who are accused of crimes who cannot afford an attorney to represent them. But when I was in Minnesota and seeing what was happening in northern Minnesota with Line 3 and the mass criminalization of protesters, the opportunity to sort of take a break from public defense and transition to doing activist defense full time was a really important opportunity for me to support the people that, are working to protect the water that is life for all of us.
So, Kira Kelly, you work with the Climate Defense Project as well. Can you say a little bit about your work?
I started the Climate Defense Project about exactly the same time as Claire. And like Claire, prior to that, had been spending the majority of my time representing water protectors arrested fighting the Line 3 pipeline. So it was an easy transition, at least in terms of my day-to-day activities, to just continue doing that work and to expand a bit into other cases, protest cases, land defense, environmental defense cases, as the Line 3 cases are resolving, phasing out. And the one difference between myself and Claire is that I'm a part-time salaried attorney at CDP. So I work for them 10 hours a week, which then is a really symbiotic relationship because it allows me to have a guaranteed baseline income and to do the rest of the work that I do for people for free.
Claire, do you want to describe maybe first a bit about the Line 3 protests and what was at stake there? It's a less familiar frontline Indigenous-led movement than Standing Rock, but profoundly important in the fight for climate justice. Can you say a little bit about Line 3 resistance and how charges were filed around water protectors?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that a knowledge of Standing Rock and what happened there really helps to inform thinking about Line 3 and what we saw with Line 3 resistance in Minnesota, because it was really Standing Rock where a lot of relationships were forged that ended up leading to a lot of the community resistance in Minnesota, a lot of lessons that were learned there on both sides. Unfortunately, I think a lot of the harm that we saw in Minnesota was harm that was predictable in terms of the harms that pipelines bring to communities, to waterways, to the environment. But also, Enbridge itself and the extractive industries have been learning as they go along on how to squash public opposition, how to undermine protests, how to undermine the community support they have, how to traumatize people to the extent that it becomes more difficult to build a sustainable movement where people are able to stay in it. And what we saw was that while Standing Rock was a particular place where there was a lot of energy and focus, Line 3 was stratified across Minnesota from the northwest border with North Dakota all the way to Superior, Wisconsin at the base of Lake Superior. And because of that, you had a lot more movement. You had Enbridge moving their drills around so that it would be more difficult for people to protest them and to disrupt the construction that they were trying to move through at a breakneck pace. And one of the other really significant things that I think Enbridge learned was they were able to recruit law enforcement to their side through an escrow account that essentially allowed Enbridge to write a blank check to Minnesota law enforcement that would reimburse them for all sorts of costs incurred related to arresting protesters and squelching resistance to Line 3 construction.
It seemed to me, though, that the frontline resistance to Line 3 also took a lot of that into account. You know, there were maps of where to go. And I know here in Oregon, there were vans of people who went back there and there was quite a coordinated way of trying to respond to that fragmentation and the division that was part of the military and state strategy of repression. I don't know if either of you could speak to some of the strategies to take into account the repressive tactics. Kira, do you want to say something about that whole scene?
Sure. And just to clarify the numbers that we're talking about here, we had over 1,000 arrests. There's a lot of uncertainty as to people who maybe got charged more than once and maybe people that got charged and we didn't know about. I also just want to say that the reason we even have this data in the first place is because there are a handful of incredible, brilliant, dedicated legal workers who were just had these databases burned into the back of their eyelids and were poring over them for years, really trying to make sure that nobody fell through the cracks. And so we might have had a couple of arrests that we didn't know about or people that we weren't able to support, but there was just so much work that went into getting this data, which is really important so that we can have these kinds of conversations and be reflective. We're probably down to a couple dozen cases out of the 1,000, maybe even less than that by now. And what I thought was really actually interesting as a different geographic reality than Standing Rock was that even though people getting arrested and actions were fairly similar to each other across all of northern so-called Minnesota and Anishinaabe territory, as opposed to Standing Rock, where it was that one discrete geographic location, what was different was the post-arrest organizing and legal strategies. So different counties had these different factors, such as the caliber of the law enforcement and the prosecutor staff, how liberal or conservative the jury pools were, and the voter database who's electing the county officials. And then as well as the defendants who are charged in different counties and their attorneys and the legal workers and organizers supporting them pursued slightly different strategies.
Claire, would you want to add anything to Kira's description of the cases that remain?
Yeah, you know, I think that you're spot on in talking about how the physical layout really of Line 3 construction meant that we had a very complex series of legal dramas that ended up unfolding. And I think that that is really maybe one more element that I would add to what Kira said that has really impacted why we have some cases that have languished and straggled. There were 967 criminal cases that we know of. And again, that goes to the amazing organizers. There have been so many people dating back years. You know, people were fighting Line 3 way back when it was being called the Sandpiper Pipeline, you know, years and years before we got to Line 3 construction in 2021. And there were Freedom of Information Act requests that were going out. There were all sorts of, you know, efforts to surveil what Enbridge was doing. And then there were also legal workers. And I think it's important to take a minute to really pause and honor that work, because that labor is often the kind of labor that doesn't get celebrated. There's not, you know, documentary films made about that important movement work, but really that movement work is what makes everything else possible.
There also are controversies not only around how to characterize water protectors versus the state calling them eco-terrorists, but even within the climate movement itself, how to think about strategies, particularly as cases linger and languish and you have different plea deals offered. I'm thinking about the case of Ruby Montoya and Jessica Reznicek, who are now serving prison terms for sabotage as part of resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline, and controversies in this case about how individual cases are handled by movement lawyers versus thinking about the way solidarity is maintained, even going through the, you know, kind of the ruthless process of the so-called criminal justice system. So there's been a lot of discussion online about those cases as coming out of Standing Rock and pipeline resistance. What are the obligations of movement lawyers? And in both representing individual clients, but also supporting the aims of a broader social movement. Kira, do you want to start and comment on that? And then Claire, I'd like your thoughts as well.
Sure. I think that it's a false dichotomy to consider individual interests as separate from movement interests. We are interdependent human beings living in community, and our movements are not going to succeed unless we recognize that. So to me, it's really simple. I don't think that we should even give the other side of the controversy the dignity of acknowledging that as a valid perspective. And I'm very upfront with clients. That's the first thing I tell anybody off the bat before I enter any sort of representation agreement with them, is that if at any point in time the prospective client decides to pursue a course of action that involves snitching, cooperation with the state, or making it more likely that somebody else will go to prison, at that point they need to find a new attorney. That's really my one firm hard line, is that that's not anything I will ever participate in as an attorney. And I'm really upfront with my clients about that, so that there's no surprises later on. And if that's not something that they're comfortable with agreeing to off the bat, then they don't hire me. Although that's never happened. I think actually, by and large, every single client I've ever had has been like, of course, that's important to me too. And it's a conversation that we have together and that we reflect back on throughout the course of the case, is how can we make sure that we are working together and making sure that we think about how our actions and choices as a defendant impact other people. So to me, it's really actually not an issue. I'm sure that as the stakes get higher in terms of like length of incarceration, I mean, the whole criminal justice system is inherently coercive, right? But when you're threatened with higher charges, it is more and more tempting to think of your personal interests as above and separate the interests of the collective. But I also think that that's just another reason why, when we are offered these opportunities to get our cases totally thrown out, such as these settlements for continuances for dismissal, where you agree with the prosecutor to have your case dismissed, that we should be extricating ourselves as much as possible from the system, so that we're not continuing to give the state the opportunity to be repressive and coercive and to pressure us to turn on each other.
Claire, can you add anything to that? That Kira's saying that, I mean, in any context, lawyers often work for somebody who's paying them in many institutions, and often have to explain the conditions and potential ethical conflicts that arise, and inform clients of the limits of their counsel. Claire, can you say anything about how this has come up as an issue, or whether you think it's not even worthy of comment? Kira says it's, but there's been quite a bit of discussion around that online, and so I don't want to elevate it more than it deserves, but the National Lawyers Guild was criticized for expelling one of the members who's an attorney for how she handled this issue. Anything you would want to say about it?
Well, I agree with everything that Kira has said, and I think that this false dichotomy that has gotten so much play is actually a reflection of the deeply capitalist colonizer assumptions that ultimately undergird our entire legal system in the United States. Everything that Kira and I do as barred attorneys is bounded by legal ethics. Legal ethics are these guardrail bumpers that we have to look out for and make sure that we are staying within those lanes at all times, especially as movement lawyers, because we come under particular scrutiny compared to many other forms of lawyering. With that said, many of those ethics rules are based on assumptions that can be contracted around if you are explicit and making sure that you are getting informed consent. I personally think that consent is important for any relationship, but certainly the attorney-client relationship. And just to give a couple of examples, one of the assumptions that the law makes is that whoever is paying a lawyer, that lawyer will be the most loyal to that person. That is an assumption that is deeply flawed and rooted in capitalism. And what it means is, for me, as a lawyer who is funded through nonprofit grants and donations and does not charge my clients, I just need to be explicit about that and be explicit about the fact that I do receive funding through grants. And because of that, I'm able to offer free legal services. And that does not change the fact that I will be loyal to my clients and not to the, you know, anonymous funders who contribute to funds to support movement people. Another example that I think is really important is the assumption that if you are targeted by the state and you can get out of it by throwing someone else under the bus, that you will do that, that you will want to do that. That is an assumption that is not true for many, many people. As Kira has said, that does not take into account that the interconnectedness of our communities and our relationships. And for many of our clients, and actually all of our clients by definition, they have chosen to forego the opportunity to potentially throw a comrade under the bus to save themselves because they personally believe that they will be better served by an attorney who understands their goals are broader than that, that they are not merely trying to escape the legal system themselves at all costs to anyone else, but rather that we are approaching things from a harm reduction perspective.
Isn't that actually built into the prosecutory system that we live under? The assumption, and it's not even something denied, that you get, you know, anyone who watches movies or TV programs about crime knows that there will be always a push to snitch, to turn on someone else, and that the prosecution depends on that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The system is built on reducing people to the smallest individual level, to isolating them, and to then convincing them that their only avenue is to turn on the community members that they have. And that is false. It is a trap. And I also cannot say enough how many times as a public defender did I go to trial and it was me sitting next to my client and the gallery behind us was empty. And I cannot tell you how different an experience it is when my client is surrounded by community members and loved ones who support them, who are outside on the courthouse lawn, you know, barbecuing, holding up a sign, creating a spirit of community and support. It's vastly different and it impacts my clients, I know, but it also impacts the court system itself. Judges act differently when people are watching. Prosecutors act differently when people are watching. We know that everyone acts differently. That's human nature, that you are on your best behavior when you're being observed. That's why there are security cameras or signs that people put up saying, you know, please note, there's security cameras here. You're being watched. Like, this is
fundamental. That's why we went with documentary crew to both of these trials and pushed to get our cameras in as close as possible.